Today on Family Talk.
Welcome to Family Talk. I'm Dr. Meg Meeker, and I have a wonderful guest on our program today. I am going solo today. My guest is Dr. Leonard Sachs. Dr. Sachs holds an MD and a PhD in psychology from the University of Pennsylvania. He is the author of three extraordinary books, Boys Adrift, Why Gender Matters, and Girls on the Edge. In December of this year, Dr. Sachs had another book on the horizon, and it's going to be a terrific one. Dr. Sachs is a popular speaker on child and adolescent issues. He speaks around the United States as well as around the world. He's appeared on CNN, NPR, PBS, and The Today Show with yours truly. That was a lot of fun. Thank you so much for being here today, Dr. Sachs.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. You currently live in Pennsylvania. You are practicing family practice, and you're writing books, and you have a daughter in Pennsylvania, too. You are one very busy man.
That's true.
Dr. Sachs, you write a lot about boys, you write a lot about girls, and you write about gender. You are a strong advocate for single-sex schools, and I wholeheartedly agree with you. You also speak very boldly about the cultural influences on our boys and our girls, and I would like you to outline what you describe in Boys Adrift as the five crucial factors that are operating against our boys that are causing them to be unmotivated and grow up to be underachievers.
I have signed off now on more than 90,000 office visits over the last 26 years. I added it up recently. Mm. And I've talked with lots of girls and lots of boys. And I am completely convinced of one thing. Kids don't really care so much about being adults. Boys want to be men, and girls want to be women.
Yes.
But we don't give them any guidance about what that means. What does it mean to be a man? The culture has really fallen apart on that parameter. 40 years ago, if you asked an American boy, what does it mean to be a man? He would have known what you meant. Mm-hmm. He would have known from the movies, the TV shows, from actors like Paul Newman, Sidney Poitier, Gary Cooper. He would have a real sense of what our cultural concept of being a man meant. But today, when asked boys, what does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a gentleman? They're grasping at straws. They're saying, well, a gentleman is someone who wears a three-piece suit. It's all about the superficials. Mm-hmm. And you can't blame them because they've received no instruction. No one has taught them what it means to be a gentleman. And in fact, the leading professors at the leading universities now say we shouldn't even use the term ladies and gentlemen, because that reinforces a sexist binary, that we should just want kids to grow up to be good citizens. But the problem is that boys and girls face different temptations. Mm-hmm. Girls and boys experience different challenges, and they need different guidance, but our culture has fallen apart in giving that guidance.
Where did the tearing down of the gentleman image, the masculine image, come from?
I think it began with the concern about sexism.
Yes.
So 40 years ago, 50 years ago, yes, the culture sent a very strong message. This is what it means to be a man. It means that you are a good provider, a good father, a good husband. And people were concerned, and I think rightly so, that the sexist stereotypes of 50 years ago were limiting for boys and for girls. The notion of a stay-at-home father was not part of the cultural concept of masculinity 50 years ago. And, of course, women had very few options 50 years ago compared to what they have today. Mm-hmm. But I think that in trying to eradicate the problems associated with sexism, we may have gone too far. By pretending that gender doesn't matter, we have not reached a paradise where boys want to sit around and talk about their feelings and girls want to be engineers and computer scientists. Mm-hmm. On the contrary, when you ignore gender, when you fail to teach what it means to be a gentleman or a lady, you don't get good citizens. You get kids who, instead of looking to the grown-ups, are looking to the internet, are looking to social media. And what American popular culture is teaching them, mm-hmm. is that being a man means having lots of sex, getting drunk, using drugs, racing your car on a city street. Being a woman means having lots of sex, dressing in a very provocative way. It's all about how you look. It's all about being cool and hanging out with cool people. Mm-hmm. Think Kim Kardashian.
Yes. So really you're talking about the breaking down of the masculine ideal, the masculine image. And this has led boys to feel very unmotivated. Do you think they just don't know what to do with themselves? Are they afraid of feeling masculine or carving out a masculine identity?
Well, the question I raised is, what does it mean to be a man?
Yeah.
And the answer is that every culture answers that question differently. What it meant in samurai Japan is different from what it meant in medieval Europe, is different from what it meant in the United States in 1950. No boy is born knowing the answer.
Right.
We no longer teach it at all.
Right.
And the result is that boys are looking everywhere they can. They are confused. They are adrift. American culture has become toxic to children and to teenagers. And that's not a guess. That's an empirical finding. Mm-hmm. And the job of the parent now is to create a different culture. Create a different culture. And I find many parents, many American parents, don't get this at all. And many fathers are playing Grand Theft Auto along with their kid.
Yes.
Because they want to be the cool dad.
Right.
They want to show they understand the kid. That's not what kids need.
Well, the way that fathers are portrayed in America is, you know, a whole nother show or two. And that
yes.
is fathers are stupid. They have nothing to teach. They're emasculated. I think many parents recognize the breakdown of any kind of moral code or structure. They recognize that we are now, as a culture, putting a premium on feelings and not doing what's right. And now this extra dimension that you're talking about, the crushing of any kind of masculine or feminine identity, just really pushes kids over the edge. And I think that in my experience, I'd like to hear your experience, parents really underestimate the powerful effect that this has on the mental health of our kids, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. And the great irony of this new orthodoxy, which is being pushed again by the leading professors at leading universities, who say we shouldn't use terms like ladies and gentlemen because that suggests a binary, that you're either a man or a woman. We want to embrace the notion that gender is fluid, these so-called experts say, and kids can find their way on the spectrum of gender between masculine and feminine. This is harmful. It is false. It's not based in data. It's based in ideology. Mm-hmm. And the result, the weird and ironic result, is that this pretending that gender doesn't matter has resulted in reinforcing gender stereotypes.
Yes.
So this girl comes in. She's 11 years old. She likes to roll in the mud and wrestle hogs. She likes to run around and kick a ball and swing from a tree. 20 years ago, we would have said she's a tomboy. Now her parents wonder if she's transgender.
Yes.
In other words, if you're not a stereotypical girl who likes to play with Barbies, you're Caitlyn Jenner.
Yes.
It's absolutely crazy. The notion of gender has been impoverished and flattened by this new construct. And it's not true. It's not factual. This girl's not transgender. She's a tomboy.
She's tomboy.
Nothing wrong with
exactly.
that. We should celebrate
yeah.
that. But she's still a girl. There's
yeah.
more than one way to be a girl. And this is very harmful to the child, very confusing to the child. Because this girl may be a tomboy, but she herself has no doubt that she's a girl.
Yeah.
And now the grown-ups are wondering, maybe she's not,
right.
at a very important point in her life. And it's the worst kind of orthodoxy because it limits what kids can do and be.
Isn't it ironic, too, and it's just so glaring to me, that when you try to throw away one gender, as Bruce Jenner is doing, and saying, I'm really not a man, I'm a woman, and then you go to a woman, you're really saying gender matters tremendously. I'm just the wrong one.
Absolutely. And a number of commentators have now pointed this out, that Caitlyn/Bruce Jenner has said, well, I really have a woman's brain, you know, because I am very emotional. Okay, that's garbage. I'm very emotional, but that doesn't mean I'm a woman. This notion that being emotional means you're female is profoundly sexist. And if a man were to say such a thing, without being transgender, he would rightly be condemned. Mm-hmm. But because of this new orthodoxy, Bruce/Caitlyn Jenner is being praised for saying really the most outrageous things. Look, you can be a man and be emotional. Verdi, who wrote very emotional operas, you know, look at the great literature, Dostoevsky.
Yes,
these were very emotional men.
Yes.
That doesn't make them female.
Right.
Human experience is complex. And men and women both can be emotional or not. They can both be passionate or not. But that doesn't change their sexual identity.
Mm-hmm. My sense has been that we have gotten to this place of sexual identity crisis, primarily because of the movement of sexual freedom. That during the 1970s, when we began championing the sexual revolution and saying sex should be free at all costs, physically, emotionally, psychologically, mentally, it sort of morphed into this breaking down of stereotypes. You know, guys can be as promiscuous as they want, women aren't going to be, and then the women said, well, we want to be as well. And then we moved into the focus on homosexuality. And now it seems we've gone beyond that, you know, into these transgender and identity issues. And I wonder if this quest to have sexual freedom is just overriding everything, or is that too simple?
Well, it's certainly part of the problem. When you go into a health class, as I have done, I have visited now about 400 schools over the last 14 years. And when you sit in a health class and a kid asks, when am I ready? When am I ready to go all the way?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is, well, you'll know when you're ready. And that answer is wrong.
It's wrong.
A 14-year-old doesn't know when they're ready. And you talk about this, I think, very powerfully in your book, Strong Fathers, Strong Daughters, where you say that depression is a sexually transmitted disease.
Yes.
Now, you and I know that's not literally true. Depression is not spread by a virus or a bacteria. But if a 14-year-old girl goes all the way, she is much more likely to become depressed than a girl who remains a virgin or than a boy who goes all the way. Again, the challenges for girls are different from the challenges for boys, and we have pretended that's not true. And the result is an explosion in the rate of depression among teenage girls.
Yes.
This new ideology is not driven by data. It's driven by a very particular ideology that is harmful to kids. Kids at age 14 are not ready to go all the way.
In no way, shape, or form.
And we no longer do.
Yeah, their bodies aren't ready. We can talk about tissue differences in the cervix. We can talk about psychological issues, intellectual issues. In no level are they ready for anything. Why are parents, modern parents, educated parents, bright parents, so hesitant to take charge, sit down with your kids and say, here's where I want to take you. This is right and this is wrong. You're a girl and this is how you should act. You're a boy and this is how you should act within limits. I mean, very, very general guidelines. Why are parents so reticent to speak?
You will still find some parents who have a very clear concept of what their job is, and they do their job. In the forthcoming book, I share a story. Her name is Marlo Phillips, a wonderful young woman who I interviewed in California. And she was so angry at her parents all through adolescence because she wasn't allowed to go to R-rated movies. She wasn't allowed to be alone with a boy. She couldn't go out on a date with a boy until the boy had been interviewed by her father. And she said to her parents, I'm going to have to be in therapy for the rest of my life because of the way you guys are treating me.
Oh, that'll work.
You are so uncool. I'm the only one. I'm the only one. And then she went to the University of Virginia, Charlottesville. And after a year there, she told me she had an epiphany. She realized, I'm not going to have to be in therapy for the rest of my life, unlike every other girl I know at this school. Because my parents gave me a sense of right and wrong, and these girls have no clue. They seriously think the best way to get popular is to give oral sex to as many boys as you can. And they don't realize, they have no concept of how degrading that is, how harmful that is, how dangerous that is. She has a clear moral sense, and that's the most important thing parents must teach. Again, that's not a matter of opinion. We now have really good studies, when you actually look at the data, where researchers have followed a group of kids from birth through childhood, through adolescence, and into adulthood, starting in one case in 1970, following these 17,000 babies right through 2008 when they're 38 years old, and interviewing these kids in childhood and adolescence, interviewing the parents. What matters? What should you be teaching as a parent? Is getting an A instead of a B really important? Is having grit and persistence really important? Is having self-control really important? Well, you don't have to guess. The most important parameter is self-control. That's what we need to be teaching to kids. And yet most American parents have lost sight of that. And some are very concerned that their kids get good grades. Others are focused on sports. But it's less common today to find an American parent who says, hey, my first job as a parent is to teach you to know right from wrong.
And do you think that parents feel bullied a bit?
I think you're absolutely right. So another parent in New York City was telling me how she had decided that her daughter would not have a cell phone. She feels it's just too dangerous. Kids are taking pictures and sending pictures and texting one another all the time, nonstop. And she said, you're not going to have a cell phone. And you know what? The other girls did not have a problem. They understood, okay, her mom won't let her have a cell phone. But the other parents are giving this mom a really hard time. The other parents are saying, you are so out of touch. You are, like, totally ruining her whole experience. But she stands her ground. But again, she's, the most flack is coming not from this girl's teenage friends, but from the other parents.
Well, and the reason the parents are doing it is to justify their bad behavior.
Their own action. That's right. Because I think at some level deep down, the fact that when they're at supper, when they're in the car, their daughter isn't talking to them. She's looking at her little screen. She's texting. She is not present for her family. I think at some level, the parents realize, hey, there's something wrong here. But rather than say, you know, maybe we made a mistake. Maybe we should get rid of the screens and look at each other when we're sitting at the dinner table. That's a bold step, and that requires courage. And a lot of parents don't have that courage. And instead, they lash out at that one parent who has prohibited the phone.
It's interesting. I don't know if you have this experience, but when I'm seeing in young parents, parents of very young children, my daughter's 31 and she has a two-year-old and another on the way, but among her friends and some of my patients with very young children, they're keenly aware of the negative effects of the screen. And I'm seeing these young women say, no screen time for my child, no screen time. And even if she walks in a room and a television's on, she'll say, you know, turn off the television, please. I don't want my two-year-old to see a screen. And I think that's very telling because a lot of these are young gals who didn't, my kids didn't have cell phones in high school because nobody did. I don't like them, but they didn't have them anyway. But somehow they've picked up, these younger parents have picked up, this is not good for our children. And we're going to try to parent in a different direction. And I applaud them.
Many parents have not figure that out. I had a young mother say to me recently, I don't know how parents in previous generations ever managed to change a diaper. And the reason she said that is because she gives her six-month-old a phone to watch, to distract the child while they're changing a diaper. And she says, if my baby doesn't have that phone, it's a nightmare. And this parent is failing to teach self-control at the most basic level.
It's one of the things
we have to experience as a human being. And this child having the diaper change is something you just have to put up with and learn a little self-control. But at 6 months of age, this child is being sent the message, we will entertain you at every moment.
You will be stimulated all the time. You won't have to rely on yourself for stimulation. We'll do it for you because we just want you quiet. Dr. Sachs, we only have a few minutes left in this half hour, and I would like to really leave on a positive note, and I would like you to talk to parents out there about a few of the most important bold steps that they can take that will help their son or their daughter stay on the right track, because we've got an audience who really wants to do well by their kids. Sure. Very bright people, and they say, okay, tell me what to do. So tell them what to do with their sons and daughters.
Here are some real concrete things. No screens in the bedroom, period. If your child does have a cell phone at 9 o'clock at night, you take it away and you turn it off, and it goes in the charger, which stays in the parents' bedroom. No screens in the bedroom. No screens when you're together. No headsets in the car. If you're in a car with your child, she shouldn't be listening to music on her device. You and she should be talking. Mm-hmm. No screens, no headsets in the car.
Talk to parents just quickly about what are they to do with this sexual identity crisis? How can a parent say to a 10-year-old boy, I am going to help you grow into a strong man? And how do you say to a 10-year-old daughter, I'm going to help you grow into a strong woman? What are some steps that parents can take to minimize confusion and to really, to use an overly used word, empower their kids to grow into a strong adult who knows who they are?
You cannot do it by yourself. You need to find a community. If you're part of a church or a community of faith, many churches have a men's group, a women's group. If they don't, they should create one, and they need to broaden that, as a number of churches have done. So that this weekend, the women's group is going on an overnight canoe trip, a group of women with a group of girls. Mm. And it's a great opportunity for your daughter to talk to other women, to create bonds across generations, to get a sense of what does it actually mean in these women's lives to be a woman. And likewise for boys and men, a time of retreat for a group of men with a group of boys. So it's not just about father to son. You've got to find a tribe, if you like. You've got to find a community of men, real men, that your son can talk to, interact with. You can't do it by yourself. You're fighting the weight of the whole culture.
Mm-hmm. And do you think it's fair to say to parents, you know, if you have strong feelings that this is right and good, to be bold enough to teach those to your kids? Don't hold back. Don't buy into the PC party line that, you know, well, we really want to honor and respect very different values about sexual identity, different thoughts about it. Yes, Bruce Jenner is a hero. To go in and tell him what you really believe and why?
I think you have to, and I think that is the Western tradition. It is the Jewish and the Christian tradition. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, you shall love the Lord your God. You read down a few lines, it says, teach them diligently to your children. That's actually not what it says. The Hebrew says, Vishinantam Livanecha, which really means to inscribe them. You shall inscribe them on your children. Mm. It's the word, Shinan, the verb, is to incise with a knife.
Mm.
That the Jewish way, the Christian way, is not to give kids a wide range of choices and let the kid free to decide. That's not age appropriate. The evidence shows strongly that puts kids at great risk, because if you set kids loose in 21st century American culture, what they're going to encounter is social media, pornography, and video games.
Mm-hmm.
You need to incise them on your children. You need to very strongly impress the way you would impress a seal and wax, the moral code, the right and wrong. Mm-hmm. And you won't get much approval from many of your friends in most parts of the United States. But that's your job. You won't get much approval from your child. And you have to respond, as one mother did that I spoke with. She said to her daughter, well, honestly, sometimes I'm not so fond of you either. But I'm your parent.
But your mom.
My job.
Dr. Sachs, we have to finish for today's program, but we have ended on a beautiful picture that you have drawn for us. I love the idea of not just impressing things on your children's heart, like you talk about in Deuteronomy, but inscribing them, taking that knife and cutting them into their children. That's hard. There's nothing easy about it. And you are writing a book on the transfer authority, and if you are free to come back and have another show tomorrow, I would love to talk about that.
Sure, I'd love to.
That'd be great. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, and we'll talk about your new book tomorrow.
Thanks again.
Wow, what a convicting message for parents we've heard today. And we need to inscribe the truth on the hearts of our children to prepare them to face the confusing messages the world sends every day. And we need to stand strong even when our kids complain or our peers don't support us. We've been listening to the first part of an interview with parenting expert Dr. Leonard Sachs, and you don't want to miss the next broadcast when he offers practical advice to help parents inscribe that truth on their children's hearts. This is Ryan Dobson saying God bless. Thanks for listening today, and we'll see you again next time on the next edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Family Talk is not associated with Focus on the Family.